Let's talk science now. And we've known for a while that living in a sterile environment doesn't equate to a healthy lifestyle. Bugs, microbes, bacteria and germs, in the right dose, they all play a key role in keeping our immune systems active and resilient. Now scientists have narrowed down what specific microorganisms we actually need in our bodies to stay healthy. Dr. Chris Smith is a virologist and our weekly science guru. He joins us from Cambridge. Chris, hello there.
Hello, Fran.
Chris, we know some germs are actually good for us, but this is about vital bacteria and the danger of losing that bacteria.
Yes, and just to expand on that very slightly, scientists around the world studying a range of creatures have shown in the past that some bacteria are absolutely essential, even not just for tissues like the immune system, but for entire tissues like a light-producing organ in a squid or in tsetse flies. The flies have to be carrying a certain microorganism in order to be fertile. If they don't have it, they can't reproduce. So what a group at Harvard decided to do was to ask an extension of this question, which is, we know, as you said, that animals that are reared, including humans, in a germ-free environment, in other words, if you don't get colonized with the right bugs early in life, then there appear to be health consequences. But they wanted to know whether any old bug would do, or whether you absolutely had to have the right sorts of bugs for your body in order to derive that health benefit. So what they did was to take a group of mice, and they reared these mice initially in a germ-free environment. That means basically you give a pregnant female mouse a cesarean section and you give birth to the pups in a sterile way, so they're not colonized with anything. They divide the animals into three groups. One group are given washings from the colon, in other words, the intestine of normal mice, so they get mouse bacteria. A second group get washings from a human, so they get the human microbiome. And the third group are kept germ-free. They don't have any colonizing microorganisms. And the team, led by Dennis Casper, and they're publishing this work in Cell this week, then followed up these mice to see what the health outcomes for them would be and specifically how their immune systems developed. And a really interesting picture emerged because the animals that got the mouse bacteria were obviously normal. The animals that got the human microorganisms showed intestines that had a thriving community of microbes, highly reflective of what you would see in a normal human, so that looked good, and the germ-free animals developed as you would expect with the usual consequences of existing in a sterile environment. But then they said, well, let's actually look at the immune systems in these animals. And the animals with the human microbiome, despite having millions of bacteria everywhere, which looked great, actually had far fewer lymphocytes, white blood cells that fight infection and regulate the immune response in the walls of their intestines and in the lymph nodes in their intestines. They also produced far less antibody that they secreted across the wall of the intestine, and they produced far fewer of these defensive proteins that the immune system secrete into the bowel to keep both good and bad bacteria at bay. And then the researchers challenged these mice with a dose of salmonella. And the animals that had the normal mouse microbiome fared very well. Animals that had the human microbiome did very badly, as did the germ-free animals. In fact, it looked like the immune response in the mice was identical to the animals that didn't have any colonizing bacteria. And this led the team to conclude that if you don't have the right spectrum of bugs there that your immune system is expecting in order to get maturation and to develop, it doesn't develop properly. And they go on to point out in their paper that in the environment in which we now live, which is increasingly sterile and dominated by hygiene, there may not be exposure to the right bacteria, and things like cesarean delivery may have something to do with that. But also there's this whole question of the use of antibiotics, or as they point out, overuse of antibiotics, especially at a young age, which could damage or affect the structure of the microbiological environment in your gut, and that could have lifelong consequences for your immune system's development.
Mm. And Chris, Huntington's disease, it's a horrible brain disease, but some advances in treatment for Huntington's.
Yes, we've discovered the gene for Huntington's disease in about 1993. There was a big collaborative consortium and there was huge fanfare because everyone thought, now we know what the gene is, then we'll be able to solve this problem, which affects about one person in every 10,000. It's actually relatively common in the grand scheme of things. The problem is that despite knowing the gene, we still are no closer to treating the disorder, because what seems to happen is that in people with Huntington's disease, they have attached to the gene an expansion of three genetic letters, CAG, and they have too many copies of these CAG repeats, as they're known, and this causes the nerve cells that express this gene to accumulate something called polyglutamine. The CAG codes for glutamine, and if you have too many CAGs, you get polyglutamine, and it builds up in the cell and effectively poisons the cell. So one way to treat this could be to try and turn off or turn down the activity of the gene. How you do that on the scale of a whole brain, though, that's a big challenge. But what a group of researchers have published in the journal Neuron this week is something very encouraging. This is Don Cleveland and his colleagues at the University of California, San Diego. They have built interfering RNA molecules, and what they are the genetic mirror image of a gene. And what happens is that they can infuse these small pieces of genetic material into the cerebrospinal fluid that bathes the brain. It gets taken up by nerve cells. It then binds to its counterpart genetic message inside the nerve cells and causes that message to be broken down. And in mice that they've made, which express the Huntington gene, which is the abnormal gene in humans who have the disease, so these mice develop the rodent equivalent of Huntington's, they're able to cut down the expression of a gene by 75%. And this effect is persistent for many months after they give the treatment. And you can see clear changes in the behaviour of the mice and also the motor problems that the mice would normally develop. They develop them much more slowly or they have attenuated symptoms. And when you look in the brain, the pathology is much reduced in these animals. And they've demonstrated you can also use this technique in a monkey, suggesting it could be possible to translate it safely to a human.
That's fantastic. Chris, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks, Fran.
Chris Smith, our science correspondent, joining us from Cambridge in the UK. You're listening to RM Breakfast. James up next with the papers. It's 11 minutes to 7.